From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with The Listen, the podcast that encourages community, cross-cultural dialogue, and open conversation. Today we kick off Season 9, a series of interviews with writers of young adult fiction. Why do our young people need to read books that tackle difficult subjects? What kind of advice do published YA writers have for the rest of us? What gap does young adult literature fill? This season, we'll be exploring these questions and many more. My guest today is Jennifer Niven. A number one New York Times and internationally best-selling author, she has written 10 books, including All the Bright Places and Holding Up the Universe. Her work has been translated into more than 75 languages, and All the Bright Places has won literary awards around the world. The film, for which she co-authored the screenplay, is now streaming on Netflix. Jennifer's latest novel, Breathless, has just been published, and she is hard at work on her next two books. She also oversees Germ, a literary and lifestyle web magazine for girls and boys age high school and beyond that celebrates beginnings, futures, and all the amazing and agonizing moments in between. Her previous works include 4 novels for adults, as well as 3 nonfiction books. She divides her time between Los Angeles and coastal Georgia with her husband, kids, and literary cats. Jennifer Niven, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'd love to start with your new novel, Breathless. Can you please tell us a little bit about which themes you chose to focus on this time?
Yes. Breathless is a very personal book, and the themes really center around sex, positivity, parental divorce, first love, heartache, loss, and finding yourself, learning to write your story.
Wow. So you really bit off a big piece there, didn't you?
I did. Absolutely.
You, I mean, you yourself mentioned that it's a personal story. So was it inspired by a specific moment or something that happened in your life?
It's interesting because this book it's personal. I always say it's personal then and it's personal now, in that then when I was the same age as Claude, who is my main character in Breathless, 18, I was going through much of what she goes through in the early part of the book, which is her parents announce they're separating. She's not allowed to tell anyone, not even her best friend. She and her mother move away, like right after high school graduation, to this remote place where Claude knows no one and feels like she's starting over and having to learn to, you know, well, begin again. And then it's also personal now because when I was researching the book, writing the book, I went to this remote Georgia island that I had been to years before, and there I met my now husband. We fell in love on that first day. All of the adventures that are in the book are adventures that Justin and I had. So we gave those to Claude and Maya. And so it's this wonderful combination of my 18-year-old self, who was not going through the best time of her life, mm-hmm. and then my not 18-year-old self, much later, meeting the love of her life. So mm-hmm. it's this lovely combination for me, a very emotional combination of, you know, a painful time in my life and a really lovely time in my life.
Had you ever undertaken that kind of exercise as a writer before? I mean, I'm sure you've mined your own experiences and memories before, but have you ever sort of paired them in that way? You know, something really intense from your past and something really intense from your fairly recent present?
Not in that way. I mean, I feel like, and I think every young adult writer, every writer, period, will tell you that you infuse so many of your characters and your stories with who you were then, who you are now, but never has it been so almost literal, like this divide between the teenage me and the adult me, and having these two intensely personal stories kind of come together.
Was that scary at all, to put something so, so personal out into the world?
Absolutely. It does not get less terrifying, even, you know, the more you do it. It's the kind of thing, like when I was writing All the Bright Places, I thought, I mean, this is a story that I wrote inspired by a boy I had loved years ago. And it took me a good 12 years to write the book, because I wasn't ready. I didn't think I could face all of that and the emotion that it comes with. And I had a young reader ask me after the book came out, how did you write All the Bright Places without crying? And I said, oh, I cried a lot when I was writing that book. And you have to feel that emotion in order for your readers to feel it. Mm-hmm. So with Breathless, even though I had written All the Bright Places and been through that kind of, you know, bleeding onto the page, if you will, it didn't make it any easier to do it again.
You mentioned adventures on this island. Is there anything specific that you can share with us, whether it's, you know, the Breathless version that's out of the book, or whether it's, you know, more a more literal memory?
One of, I think, my favorite adventures that Justin and I had, and that I gave almost literally to Claude and Maya in the book, is we were driving through this island, which, and you have to understand, like, this island is like this remote enchanted place. It looks like something out of Grimm's fairy tales. It's like live oaks with Spanish moss and palm trees. There are no vehicles on the island unless they belong to residents, and they're only, I think, 11 people who live there full time.
Oh my goodness.
Or the park service, because it's a national park. So there are roads, but they're not paved. They're all sand. And every now and then you see some sort of vehicle. Justin had a truck because he was living on the island at the time. And we drove through the night. I think this was on our first day that we met, in the complete darkness with no headlights on. And he said this wise thing, which I put into the book, about someone had told him once that you can see in the dark. You just have to trust yourself, and we have that ability. And I thought, that's such a wonderful metaphor.
It is.
We were going through the dark, and then we saw these fireflies and lightning bugs through the trees, and they were what was lighting our path. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is like one of those moments I'll never forget. So I gave that to Claude.
Oh, that is wonderful. That is a wonderful metaphor, that if you don't, well, I'm kind of turning it, you know, giving it a little twist here, but if you don't trust that you can see in the dark, and therefore try to see in the dark, you won't ever know if you can.
Exactly. I love the way you put it.
It's beautiful. A beautiful memory and a beautiful image. You painted such a beautiful image.
Thank you.
I'm curious about the names of your characters. I haven't had the privilege of reading your book or even reading any excerpts from your book, but you mentioned that their names are Claude, the girl is Claude, and the guy is Maya, which on the face of it sound like the girl has a boy's name and the boy has a girl's name. Was that intentional? Were you playing with that?
It's not intentional in that way, but I will say, when I was naming Claude, I mean, names are so important to characters because they help you see the character. They have to feel organic. And I love a strong name. Her name is Claudine, but I love the boy nicknames. And so it just helped me see her better. Like, once I landed on Claude, I was like, oh, I can just see her suddenly. And Maya is short for Jeremiah, and she calls him Maya, as his only the closest people to him do. It just happened to be that it sounds like Claude is the boy and Maya is the girl. I notice now when I'm posting about it or talking about it, I definitely have to clarify, because there is some confusion sometimes, so
yeah.
Understandable.
Yeah, but it's good confusion, you know? I think there's a lot of that in the air these days that, you can't really assume anymore. And it's good to ask questions about those sorts of things.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And I will note that a lot of my friends say I conjured my husband because I had started writing about Jeremiah Crew long before I met Justin Conway. So they have the same initials, and there are all these other similarities, like they both walk barefoot everywhere across the island, and they have similar backstories. And it was so eerie when I met him because I was just, for a moment, I was like, is this real? Like, this is too good to be true.
So you went there to write, right? You went to the island to work on your novel, but you had already started it. You already had an idea of, you know, who the characters were and what the story was.
I tend to do a lot of preparation at the beginning, so it tends to be very front-loaded in terms of the work that I do on a book. There's the term, we talk about it a lot in YA, about whether you're a pantser or a plotter, and I'm somewhere in between. So I go by the seat of my pants, but I also know the main beats of where I'm going. Okay. And for me, the most important thing is getting to know the characters. And so I do all this character work ahead of time. I have to know them intimately. And that helps inform, you know, the plot. It helps inform what they would do, what they wouldn't do. And so by the time I had gotten to the island, I was about to start the actual writing, but I had been doing character work and story work well ahead of time.
I am very interested in your process, and we're going to come back to that later. I'd really like you to talk to us about maybe some advice you have, and you know what your sort of how you organize your time, sort of throughout a project, but also on a day-to-day basis. But before we get to that, I want to go back to what you said about this project being so personal, and I'd love to ask you more about what it's like to really open yourself up on the page as a writer. Is this something that you've known how to do all along? Is that one of the reasons that you have had the success that you've had, because it's sort of innate to you? Or would you say that this is a skill that you've learned over the years with each book that you've taken on?
It's a great question. And it's I have the answers kind of both, in the sense that my mom was also an author. And one of the most wonderful things she did was always encourage me to write once she learned I loved to write. And she also encouraged me to put my feelings down on paper. And so I remember one of the most autobiographical stories and personal stories I wrote, like one of the earliest stories I wrote, I was in fourth grade. We just moved to Richmond, Indiana, and I wrote a story called My Life in Indiana, or I Will Never Be Happy Again, and gave it to my parents. And my dad was like, oh, great. I'm so glad you encouraged her to write her feelings down. but then years later, I went to film school to earn my graduate degree in screenwriting. And I remember my fellow screenwriters saying, we worry that you're not able to put yourself on the page, to really reveal yourself and your emotion. And we think that's going to get in the way of things, because they were really pouring like all of their love and heartache and everything onto the paper and into their scripts. And I was writing like a cute story about a Midwestern town that thinks Disney's coming to build a theme park there. And I thought it was adorable and I had so much fun, but they were really concerned. And I took that to heart. I mean, I felt like, oh God, what if I can't do that? What if I've lost the ability to do that? And then wrote for adults, nonfiction and fiction, and put elements of myself in them, in the books, certainly. But it wasn't until All the Bright Places that I really was like, okay, this is the test to see if you can actually do that. And I didn't tell anyone I was working on it except my mother. And then I was, because I thought, if I can't do it, no one needs to know about that. Right. But I was able to do it, and I was really proud of myself because I'm a private person, and that was really hard. It's very, you feel very vulnerable and exposed. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it was a very conscious decision that you made. It was, you know, sort of going out to the end of the high dive and saying, all right, I'm going to actually take the leap.
It's a great way to put it. Exactly. It was very conscious.
How beautiful that it paid off. You know, do you think that, I mean, it sort of sounds like, it reminds me a little bit of Malcolm Gladwell, who talks about how, you know, when things come together, it's not an accident. It's not just, you know, a fluke. It's because you went to film school. You started writing when you were in fourth grade. You know, it's not like you hadn't put in the hours, right?
Right. That is
true. Do you think it also has to do with sort of where you were in life? Do you think you were at a point in life where you could take that leap?
I do. I think a couple of things happened around that time, and the most significant was my literary agent of 15 years and my good friend died very suddenly and unexpectedly. And I had to rethink, first of all, I had to get a new agent, and they were asking about, you know, what I was interested in writing. And I had just finished the fourth novel in a series of adult historical novels. And I was thinking long and hard about what I wanted to do next. And the last time I saw my then agent, John Ware, in person, he said, "Kid, whatever you write next, I want you to write it with all your heart, even if it terrifies you." And he just kept saying that throughout that evening. And that's the last time I ever saw him. And so I kept thinking about those words. They haunted me. And that summer, as I was finishing up a book for adults and I had to find a new agent, I kept thinking about that. And I thought, the thing that terrifies me is writing about this boy I loved and lost to suicide years ago. Mm-hmm. So I think for John and for myself and for this boy, I'll try to write it and see if I can do it. And so I think, had all those things not happened, I think that I don't know if I would have written it.
What about fear? Do you think that fear needs to be an element? I mean, do you think you need to sort of lean into the fear and seek it out? Or is it just something that you need to write in the face of if it's there?
That's a really good question. I think all writers have an element of fear as we're writing. I think there's the fear that we can't do it. We don't know what we're doing. The other books were a fluke, that we're not going to be able to capture the things that are in our minds and in our hearts the way we want to on the page, that no one will read them if we do manage to do that, and that, you know, we'll fail in some way, and, you know, we'll fail our characters or ourselves or our publishers or whomever. So I think there's definitely that fear, and I think it feels kind of inherent in being a writer, being an artist. I think that, you know, being a human, I mean, really. Yeah. So I think that just writing through that fear is something that you have to do. And I had to, you know, especially writing for teens, for young people about serious issues like suicide, mental health, things that they go through on a daily basis and that not so many people want to talk about all the time when it comes to teens, but which is a huge global problem in terms of suicide rates. I think that it's so important to write responsibly, honestly, frankly, and out of a real place. And that was such a fear when I was writing it, because I thought, oh, I have all this responsibility. I have to get it right. Mm-hmm. And all you can do is write it out of your heart and soul and be as responsible as possible. And so once I told myself that, I was able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, responsible. And also the word that comes to me is respectful.
Yes.
Your voice, especially in All the Bright Places, really struck me as being so respectful of, you know, the specific characters in your story, but also the generation that they come from. And I can just, you know, I'm not a member of that generation, but I can just imagine how important that is to have an adult address the issues that you're struggling with respect. Jennifer, we're going to need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to continue our conversation. Back in a second.
The Listen Podcast is sponsored by RAF, cutting edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit rafsanpedro.es. That's RAFFSANPEDRO.ES.
This is Kate Jetmore with The Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jennifer Niven, author of All the Bright Places. Her new novel, Breathless, has just been released. Jennifer, it's interesting. I didn't realize that you went to film school. So I really want to ask you about, I'd love to know how your new book, Breathless, differs from your bestseller, All the Bright Places, and what you learned from the process, not only of writing the novel, All the Bright Places, but creating the screenplay for the film that came out of it, and which of those lessons you brought to this new project.
I think, first of all, it's interesting when you write. I've written now 10 books, and actually 11. I have one that's coming out next year that I haven't yet gotten to talk about to anyone in the world. But it's interesting with each one. You think that you should have it down in terms of, you know, oh, yeah, so I've done all these books. I know how to write a book now. But each one wants to be written so differently. And it doesn't matter how personal it is or if it's, you know, similar in genre. It's just they want to be written differently. And so that's one thing I've learned. But All the Bright Places, in terms of Breathless, it did prepare me for digging deep and going to uncomfortable places that sometimes I don't want to go to. Like, certainly on a daily basis, if I'm not at my computer, I won't necessarily think, oh, that was a sad time. Let me relive that over and over again. But you do that when you're composing. And so I certainly learned to be as comfortable as you can be with something like that, but it doesn't make it any less fresh, I guess, unless the wound doesn't, I mean, it's just as fresh in some ways. And in terms of the screenwriting, I went to the American Film Institute for screenwriting, and I'm so glad I did, because I learned so much about dialogue and about writing succinctly and making every word count. It's interesting that I went immediately from AFI and screenwriting to writing novel, or to writing books. Actually, my first book was nonfiction, so I went to books instead of film. So I got to kind of brush off the dust all those years later when I wrote the script for All the Bright Places. And I think the first thing I had to learn was, one, you can't make a 16-hour movie because only you will watch it. And I so wanted to, because I wanted every scene, of course, from the book and the movie. So you learn what needs to stay and what needs to go, what is more visual, what is more dynamic, what will work on screen, what won't work. And also, it's interesting because I'd already written All the Bright Places. I thought, okay, so I can write the script, no problem. There's something to me more removed about scripts anyway. I don't feel the emotional like heft that I feel when I'm writing a book, but it was just as emotional and just as, I mean, I felt like I had almost never written that story before, and now I was writing it for the first time. Yeah,
it reminds me of when you see a movie. I don't know if you speak other languages, or if you've ever like watched a movie in another language and understood it. But I live in Spain, and I live in a pretty small town in Spain. So when you go to the cinema, all the movies are dubbed. You don't have like the art house option of going to a place with subtitles. And it's awful, but that's another conversation. but I've had this experience many times where I start watching a movie and I think, that's weird. I think I've seen this before, but it's not, but I haven't. And it's because I've already seen it dubbed, and now I'm watching it in the original version.
Interesting.
And that's what I hear you saying. That's a similar, like a little bit of an echo there of what you're saying, which is, it's this, I've been here before, I've told this story before. I've written this story before. And yet it is its own thing. You know, it's a different voice.
It's exactly how it feels. And then it's so strange to watch it, because that's another experience altogether, is seeing these actors like saying your words and being your characters. And it's just this surreal feeling. I mean, they're bringing them to life in a way that you didn't even imagine. And and they're capturing them at the same time they're bringing all of their own magic to it. So it becomes this whole other entity.
And right.
It's also fascinating.
Also, their youth. I mean, they are the age of those characters, whereas
yes.
for you, it's, you know, you were the age of those characters,
exactly.
but it's a memory now, you know?
Exactly.
And they actually are in that, you know, 16-year-old body or 18-year-old body. You know, you said you can't write a 16-hour movie, and no, you can't write or watch a 16-hour movie, but in today's world, I'm wondering, you know, your movie, what did end up being made with and for Netflix, were there ever any discussions of whether it would be a series rather than a movie?
You know, briefly, but I think that by the time really that Netflix came into the process, they came in like a year, you know, before it actually aired, and we had been, I mean, we had optioned the project 5 years earlier, so actually right before the book came out. It was already optioned. Elle Fanning was already attached. And I think we decided, Elle and the producers and I decided early on, and Elle is one of the producers, that it should be a movie instead of a series, because of the nature of the story. And I won't give any spoilers, but, you know, it's definitely a standalone as opposed to something that's ongoing. And mm-hmm. and so we decided that we thought a movie would be the best way to tell it. Mm-hmm. I just thought it should be much longer than it ended up being.
I'll bet you had to make some tough decisions while you were writing it and while the movie was being edited. Were you part of that?
I was, I mean, to a degree. I was very fortunate that, because so many writers, they don't know what is going to happen to their work once it's optioned. You know,
right.
they kind of are kept out of the process. And I was so lucky to be not only involved in writing the script, but in the casting and in like being on set. And with the edits, they showed me two or three different versions of the film. And then I gave them my notes.
Oh, that's great.
So I know that there were many other versions that I did not see. But I was so, you know, grateful to get to make notes on the ones that I did. And I felt that my notes made a difference, which made me really happy too. But it was such a great team. And it was really interesting to take this story that was such a personal one that started with essentially this boy that I loved and me. And then suddenly there are all these people collaborating on it and having a say. And it was really actually wonderful to have everyone involved in that.
Well, it sounds like an incredibly positive experience. And of course, my mind goes back to Breathless, which is your new novel. This has just been released. But do you think we might be seeing this story on the big screen as well? Are there any plans there you can share with us?
Well, I can tell you that it has been optioned by the producers of All the Bright Places.
Okay.
So they have it right now, and that's all I can really say about it, but mm-hmm. I'm very excited about that. And
oh, that's wonderful. I'm very excited about that.
Good. Oh, good.
That's wonderful. It sounds like you have a lot of balls in the air. I mean,
yes.
You've got, do you want to share with us what the balls are that you have in the air?
Sure. I've got, let's see, so I'm writing the script for Holding Up the Universe, which has also been optioned as a movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited to be writing the script for that. So I'm working on that. I'm also working on, I have this novel I alluded to, this young adult novel that is coming out next year that I wrote with another young adult author. Soon I'll be able to say more mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. Very excited about that. And I have another young adult solo book that I'm working on, and just thinking about a middle grade book as well. And I've also talked to another friend of mine who's also a YA writer, and we're talking about doing a book together.
Are these your first times collaborating with another writer?
Yes, it's been, I mean, except for film, I mean, definitely in book form. And with the author, with our book that's coming out next year, this author just sent me a chapter out of the blue and said, this just came to me, and I don't know, I thought maybe we could write something together, see what you think. And I was just so excited and so flattered because this author's been around for a while and was always one of my favorite YA authors. So I was like, yes!
That and is wonderful. I can't wait to hear more. I can't wait to hear more about that. Jennifer, I mean, I don't know what the future holds, but it sounds like from what you've shared with us that you have written and published in other genres, but that at the moment you are very clearly focused on writing for young readers. I'd love to talk a little bit more about, I mean, you alluded to it before when you were talking about the theme of, the subject of suicide in All the Bright Places. Why do you think that young people need books that take on these subjects that aren't always easy?
I mean, I feel like we just need to be talking about them more. We need to have more discussions about these kind of issues. I did not anticipate when writing All the Bright Places the kind of reaction and response I would have from readers. And I hear still, like 5 years later, after the book's publication, I hear on a daily basis from multiple readers, sometimes hundreds of readers daily, who are struggling with suicidal thoughts, who are struggling with their mental health issues, who are struggling with depression and loss, and they feel alone. And the book and books like them, like All the Bright Places, they remind these readers that they're not alone and that they matter and that other people are out there feeling the same way and that they can get help. And that is the most extraordinary thing to me because I didn't anticipate that. And I'm so grateful to these young people for sharing their stories with me, for allowing me to know what they're going through so that hopefully I can send them, you know, some resources and guidance for, mm-hmm. you know, help. I have a lot of resources on my website for helplines around the world. And it's just so necessary and so important. And I know that there are so many countries where it's just taboo to talk about. And the readers are so, when I've gone to Brazil or the Philippines in particular, they're so grateful because finally they have this like outlet and they just pour these stories out to you. And they're just this love and honesty. And it's just so crucial. I had many adults when All the Bright Places came out criticize the book for talking about this kind of thing to teens. And they said this is out there, but they can wait to know about this. They don't need to learn about it now. But the unfortunate thing is they do know about it. They are going through it. And chances are many of the children of those people who objected to it are the ones writing to me saying that they don't want to burden their parents and they feel alone. So it's just so vital that we address these things because they are living them.
Yeah. You know what I hear? I hear that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like one of the most special things for you about writing fiction for young readers is your audience.
Absolutely. I always say to them, they are my brightest places. They truly are. They're just, All the Bright Places and these young readers have changed my life completely. And I never forget that. I mean, there's not a day that goes by that I don't acknowledge that in some way. And I feel honored in any way if I've helped them. They always say, like, you've saved my life and you know, you're the reason I'm here. But I try to remind them that you saved your life. If I helped in any way, I'm so honored, but you are the one who saved your life and you are the reason you're here.
Right, right. Oh, you're so lucky to have them and they're so lucky to have you.
Thank you. I am lucky. I feel very lucky.
Let's take another short break and we'll be right back to talk more with YA author Jennifer Niven. It is such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. If you visit our new website at thelistenpodcast.com, you can let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. I'm also hoping you'll subscribe to our podcast. When you rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps to widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. You can find us on social media and check out the Listen blog, also available on our website. Once again, that's thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Jennifer Niven about her career as a writer of young adult fiction. Jennifer, before we continue, why don't you let our listeners know how they can access your work, whether it's your website, your blog, social media?
I am I have a website that's www.jennifernivin.com. And as I mentioned earlier, I have a lot of resources on there for helplines, counseling, lots of mental health resources on my resources page there. But you can also find me on Instagram, which is my absolute favorite, at Jennifer Niven. I'm also on Twitter at Jennifer Niven and Facebook at Jennifer Niven.
Okay, well, that's wonderful. And we'll put that information on our website as well so people can be sure to find you. So I'm so excited about this part of the interview where we get to your process as a writer. I'd love to know what your days look like, and also kind of, you know, if we could zoom out a little bit and you know, what each project looks like. Could you talk us through that a little bit?
Of course. So the days, it depends on what is happening. I mean, right now, there's a lot of breathless publicity and, you know, interviews and articles and things like that, which is amazing. I love doing them. So it's more unusual at the moment. And I think the thing that I've learned about my kind of daily routine is that it's always different. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of, as my mom used to call it, housework of like being a writer. So there are a lot of emails and texts and DMs and like things like that. I try to carve out, and sometimes it changes when it is during the day. I try to carve out a time to do creative work. And sometimes every now and then I get an entire day to do that and it feels so amazing and I feel so like excited. Sometimes it's an hour a day. Sometimes it's a couple hours a day. And I just tend to, unless I'm under deadline, I tend to follow the thing that I'm feeling the most like wanting to do. Mm-hmm. So something always steps up first and says, oh, me. So mm-hmm. I follow that idea. But there's a lot of, like, I do a lot of things on social media and that, you know, I tend to try to plan those out as much as I can. But there are others that I just, you know, kind of put up there sometimes. So you have to be flexible mm-hmm. because there is no such thing as like, I wish there were, like, I sit down at this time and then I'm done at this time. I keep office hours, but you never know what is going to be happening from one day to the next,
right.
Usually.
Right.
So it can be very, but it's wonderful too.
Would you say that the schedule that you try to keep to is there will be, I don't know how much it'll be, but there will be a little bit or a lot of creative time each day. Is that what you try to stick to?
Try to, definitely. I mean, I get very antsy. If I'm a generally very like happy, positive person, but I do, like, when I get edgy or grumpy, it's just because I haven't been able to write. Mm-hmm. Like, that is almost always the source of it. And I try as much as I can to do at least like an hour of creative work a day. I like to do it much longer. I can do that if I'm like forming characters, if I'm, you know, depending on the stage I'm in with the project. If I am doing like heavy lifting writing, if I am want to lose myself in a first draft and I need to like really feel all the emotion and really, you know, dig deep in there, mm-hmm. I have to have a long block of time because I can't just drop into that. Mm-hmm. I have to, you have to get into your flow and your rhythm, but then you also have to isolate and kind of just lose yourself in it and immerse. Mm-hmm. So for that type of writing, I really try to take, you know, days, like a period of days at a time and do all that writing like all day long, mm-hmm. as opposed to chopping it up with like the emails will have to be, they have to wait at that point.
Yeah. Do you ever feel like you need, in order to have a stretch of hours for creative work, especially if you have kids, which I know you do, you have to be proactive about that. You have to create that space or, you know, create that, you know, either physical or mental space. Do you ever feel like you need to create that space just for your own mental health as a writer and as a person, so that the creative moments can come later?
Absolutely. I think that's so important. And I think it's important for all of us, no matter what we do, is to have that time for yourself, to recognize when you do need that time for yourself. And I try to keep myself in balance, if that makes sense. And part of that, for me, a huge part of that is getting to write. Mm. And so I try to speak up for the times when I know I need to write, not just for whatever deadlines I have, but for me. Mm-hmm. And it's always been so important to me as a form of self-expression and a part of who I am. So I have to, that's such a necessary part of life for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I read on your website that one of your high school teachers, and you are from Richmond, Indiana, as you mentioned, as am I, so I think you might have had this teacher in common, that one of your high school teachers encouraged you to aim for, quote, pure economy of word, which is beautiful. Do you have any mm-hmm. advice for listeners out there who may be interested in expanding their writing practice or starting a writing practice from scratch? Could you share some of your do's and don'ts that you've discovered over the years?
Absolutely. My mother was the wisest person ever about anything, but particularly about writing. And so much of my writing advice comes from things that she said, and one of them was, there are going to be so many people in this world who tell you no, so don't be one of them. Mm. Always believe in yourself and in your work. And I think that is one of the best pieces of advice that I like to give, which is like, always remember why you started writing what you're writing, and believe in it, believe in yourself. And there are always going to be these negative voices that come in, including your own. Mm-hmm. You just have to stick with it. And it sounds trite, but you have to write. You just have to show up to do the writing. I know a lot of people who I think are great natural writers, but they don't have the discipline to actually see it through. And without that, nothing will get written. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to write. You have to tell yourself it's okay if it's not good at first. Mm-hmm. You can go back and edit it. I know that the fear of not being perfect stops a lot of people from working and writing, and you have to put that aside. I mean, it's hard, but you have to, because editing is so much a part of writing. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have anything on the page, you can't edit anything.
Right.
I also tell people to read. Just read everything. And don't limit yourself in what you read, and don't limit yourself in what you write. Just never limit your imagination.
Mm. Oh, I love that. I love that. Because as you said, the world is full of people who will put limits on you. So, you know, don't join the crowd in putting limits on you, on yourself.
Exactly.
Oh, that's great advice. That's great advice. I think we already touched on this, but is there anything you can share about the projects you're working on now and what we can hope to see from you in the coming months and even years? I mean, you mentioned that you do have a book that's due out next year. Anything else you can share?
I'm hoping to, you know, I was really fortunate to get to work on the All the Bright Places script, and I'm really excited to get to work on the Holy of the Universe script. So I'm also hoping to write the Breathless script when it's time. Uh-huh. So I love the idea of adapting my own works for the screen. Mm-hmm. And I love working in television and film. It's so different from working in books, but books will always have my heart. Mm-hmm. And that's where I feel most at home. So my like challenge right now is to not be working on too many at one time. Like that is always, I always talk to my wonderful agent, who I started working with after my previous agent passed away, and her name is Carrie Sparks, and she's just this like fireball of energy. And she's like, okay, I'm going to have to tell you no at some point. I don't want to tell you no, but you're going to have to, I'm just going to have to tell you to wait on this one for a little bit. Yes, you can do it, but wait on this one. So I'm just really excited. I mean, I work on one project and it feeds, that creativity feeds the other project, and that feeds this project and that one. So I'm happiest when I'm working on multiple projects at once. I'm tired, but I'm happier.
Oh, that sounds like the best kind of happy trouble. Jennifer and Niven, thank you so much for joining us on the Listen podcast. I'm really grateful that you could join us, and it's been such a pleasure getting to know you better. And congratulations. Likewise. On the release of your new novel, Breathless.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This has been absolutely wonderful.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Next time on The Listen, we'll be joined by James Bird, a Native American author from the Ojibwe tribe. His debut novel, The Brave, was published this summer. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. If you enjoyed this interview, I encourage you to check out the conversations in Season 6, featuring writers Devorah Rogers, Brooke Berman, and J. Edward Kraft. Explore the full archive at thelistenpodcast.com. There are dozens of interviews waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. I want to thank our producer, Lauren Lovett, and E.J. Jetmore, who handles our social media. And many thanks to Lucas Munoz Jetmore for editing the show, providing tech support, and writing our theme music. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is The Listen.